What's the deadliest job in America? Not ice road trucking, not fishing for crabs. The deadliest job in America?
Tower Dog.
I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, Tower Dog, Life Inside the Deadliest Job in America. Douglas Scott Delaney is the author of Tower Dog. Doug, what is the Tower Dog?
Tower Dog is essentially one of 9 to 12,000 workers across the country who actually install the technology, physically install the technology that makes everything work. Your cell phones, your Wi-Fi, your internet. 0.02% of the population is serving 365 million people. Tower Dogs are these men. That's who they are. You don't know them, you don't see them, but they do it. That's what a Tower Dog is. They climb towers, they install the technology in all kinds of weather, all kinds of areas. That's what a Tower Dog is.
And you come by your knowledge of this subject firsthand. You worked as a Tower Dog for how long?
Over 20 years, easily. Since 1989, I climbed my first tower in El Dorado, Kansas, and I just got off my last one about 3 weeks ago. So yeah, I've been on a few of them. Thousands, actually. When you see them lights blinking in the sky, if it's red or it's white, that's a tower. That's what makes your stuff work. Without it, you don't survive. I don't mean that in a physical sense. You don't survive in a social sense, in a monetary sense. Your world stops without this technology. Very few people do it. I mean, very, very few people do this job. They're phenomenally underpaid, phenomenally underappreciated, and they're dying at a rate unprecedented in any other technology we've had in any industry.
Before we get into why this job is so deadly, let's go back to 1997. Tell me about that first climb down in El Dorado.
My first climb was in El Dorado, Kansas, just before Christmas. It was 30 degrees on the ground, and it was zero at the top of this 240-foot tower south of El Dorado Lake with a 35-mile-an-hour wind. I never thought I'd survive. It was horrible. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But I did it. I still don't know how. I still don't know why. It was just a miserable, lousy day. I remember thinking, why would anybody want to do this? Obviously, it wasn't for the money. It was for something else. So the camaraderie of the men I was with, I was working with people I knew, but it wasn't fun. That's all I can say.
So what made you go back to do it again and again and again?
The truth is, there's romanticism about it. It's a gypsy business. It's a roving business. We travel all over the country, all over the world. We go where the service is needed. Most people spend 6-8 weeks on the road, 1 week at home. Yeah, they range in age from 18 years old to 70, still climbing towers. You can see the country. You can travel all over the place. It's kind of romantic, meaning you're on the cutting edge of a technology that even back then was very new. What we were doing back then, which is almost less than 20 years ago, was very simplified cell service. Now it's turned into a plethora of services, and they all go through cell phone towers. Nothing goes through your telephone line. Nothing really goes through Cox Cable. What goes through Cox Cable goes through towers. Everything goes through towers. You don't even know it exists. The romanticism comes behind the idea that you're on the edge of a technology. If you think about all the technological surges through history, and you can go back. You can go back to the wheel. But if you think about, say, the last 150 years, you're talking telephone lines, railroad lines, cattle drives, especially cattle drives. There was a specific type of person who did that job for not a lot of money, just to make money and get through, who were providing massive remuneration for the companies that provided it, whether it was a railroad line or a telephone line or a transatlantic line or a beef company or it was Armor Beef. It doesn't matter. There's the men in the trenches that do the actual work, and they're usually a very small percentage of the men in the field. If you look at Tower Dogs specifically, the estimates are so unknown because nobody knows how many of us there are. Some say 10,000, some say 15,000. That's high. You think about 15,000 people who have a support work base of millions of people working for Sprint and AT&T and Verizon and whoever. There are still these four-man crews running around the country like gypsies, climbing these towers in all types of horrible weather and conditions to make sure that your phone works. So you can tweet, while you're there, get me some milk.
Let me read you a quote from your book, Tower Dog, Life Inside the Deadliest Job in America, about just that, the impact of our cell phones. You say, nothing has had a more direct, more all-encompassing, more moment-by-moment, second-by-second on Americans than the cell phone and its ever-changing and ever-adaptable technology.
Mm-hmm. That's absolute fact. What has changed your life since you were born than a cell phone? Interstate, television, cable TV, Mars, space? No, what has changed your daily life more than anything than a computer you can hold in your hand? And it literally is that. It used to be a cell phone 20 years ago. Now it is not a cell phone. It is a device. It's a delivery device, basically for advertising and revenue. That's what a cell phone is. Advertising, revenue. That's all a cell phone is, okay? Now, what has changed your life more? How has your family life changed between you and your children, between you and your employer more than this? What is the internet? Okay, the internet is cell phone. The internet, well, I shouldn't say cell phone. The internet is this tower technology, of course. The bottom line is, can you think of one thing has changed your life more?
Not even close.
Not since, quote unquote, sliced bread has anything changed the world so much. You can probably go back. If you want to really speak technologically, civilization went thousands of years until, say, electronics gave us telephone, telegraph, typewriter, the automobile.
Okay. Radio.
I think that would be a fair guess to say since the automobile, nothing really has changed American life as much, and that was 1904. So you take 1904 and the advent of the mass-produced automobile, what really has changed American life and the culture and the way we look at anything than the cell phone? I contend nothing. I can't believe there's one thing that would do it. I can't believe there's one thing more important, or I wouldn't say more important, but that has changed the way we live our daily lives more than cellular or tower technology.
And yet most of us don't give a second thought to what it takes to make that technology come to us. We don't really think about the men, and they're mostly men, who are up there, I was going to say climbing the cell phone towers, but you point out in your book, Tower Dog, there is no such thing as a cell phone tower.
Yeah, it's technically a bad phrase. They're communication towers. A cell phone tower carries mostly cellular technology, which is for your phone. But there's also broadcast, radio. It's all on towers. Everything's on towers. There are no ground-based systems, really, that compare to the amount of information and use of technology we get through that tower. But you brought up something interesting. You had said, you know, we don't think about it. Well, why should you? It's hand-delivered. When I was a kid and I watched TV, I didn't worry about where it was coming from. When Disney did Color on Sunday night, The Wonderful World, I didn't think about it. When HBO came out, I didn't think about it. You just absorb it and you accept it. It's a part of your life. And the younger you are, and these children today, they don't know what a rotary phone is or a dial-up phone is. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But there is a price to be paid for the technology that we don't even understand and take for granted and absolutely take advantage of. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that price that is paid is sort of what is at the crux of this book.
Yes.
You started climbing towers back in 1997. Jump forward a couple decades. What made you want to write a book about what it's like being a tower
dog? What happened was, we had always been told in the industry, you're doing the deadliest job in the world. This is the deadliest job in America. You get one mistake, you don't get two. You don't get three strikes, you get one. What happens is any ground-based thing, you fall off a ladder or you cut a wrong wire, you might get hurt and you get a boo-boo On towers, one mistake and you are physically dead. It's how it happens. Gravity wins is the expression. What happened was I had already been in the business about 10 years. They had not been keeping records, really, in this industry was largely unregulated for decades. I mean decades. Since the radio towers went up in the 30s, no one was really regulating the labor force on these towers until maybe, seriously, 1993. You know, that's maybe the earliest they started paying attention, or OSHA started looking at tower work fatalities. I was literally called to go to a job in New Jersey. I was living in Lawrence, Kansas. I was driving out on K-10. And I passed a tower that I always see out by Eudora. It's a 2,000-foot broadcast tower for a TV station out in Kansas City. Now, I could see that tower from my backyard. I live in the country. About 14 hours later, I landed in New Jersey, pulled into a diner, opened up the USA Today, and read, two men die in cell phone tower accident, Eudora, Kansas. That's what started it. And I called back home, checked out the Lawrence Journal World, talked to my wife at the time, said, what is going on there? And they told me this story about two men who had died on that tower in Eudora. And that's what started me looking at numbers and making me look. These two men had been in the business a long time. They fell a long way. They died a horrible death. They had wives. They had families. They had kids. They were just doing their jobs. And that's how the book really started, was when I read that article, which was literally three lines in USA Today. Then I started researching back through many websites, finding towers all over the country where these accidents had occurred, but there was no cohesion to it. It was the only way you knew about it is if it happened near you. And then there was finally a website that came online, frankly called Wireless Estimator, who started tracking and reporting these things. And we found out, bar none, that A, it's the deadliest job in America, to they die at a rate sometimes every 30, 40 days you're going to lose somebody. It was just unknown and completely unappreciated. But that's really what started me getting on the book.
Once you started looking into fatality rates for tower dogs, what surprised you about that?
I was appalled that the most amazing statistic is 1 year, and it's in the book. I'm not here to say in the book, that we lost six guys in 24 days. Every one of them was their own fault. How does that happen? Is this a dangerous job? But what I found out that there are periods of time in the industry, especially when it's booming, when you're working for what they call carriers, whether it's Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, it doesn't matter who they are. They're a carrier. They are the people who are making the money from you and your cell phone. They are the ones putting men in the field. Okay? What I found appalling was there were times, and you can track this, it's all recorded, that we would lose a guy every 6 days or a guy every 8 days. The minimum was a guy every 40 days, which is still is horrible. It is worse than when they built Hoover Dam or the Verrazano Narrows Bridge or the Empire State Building and World Trade Center. These death rates are crazy. And why? Why is this happening? Largely because they are underpaid, they are untrained, and they are thrown into the field under serious time pressure to deliver a service so these carriers do not lose money. That's the bottom line, okay? Everybody thinks they make a lot of money. They do not. They do not make a lot of money. They make no more than the manager of your local quick shop, okay? And he's on the ground, okay? What I found completely appalling, again, was there are layers of separation between that man on the tower and the carrier. AT&T hires General Dynamics. General Dynamics hires Joe Blow Construction Company. Joe Blow Construction Company hires Three Guys Tower Service. Three Guys Tower Service goes and does the work on the tower. They lose a guy. They're responsible. the stuff never slides up. AT&T will never be responsible. They have insulated themselves like you wouldn't believe. They actually send out press releases that are appalling to read. They're like, this carrier company always stresses safety, but let it be known that this company did not work directly for us. They actually say that in press releases that are in the book and verifiable. It is all a matter of CYA for profit, in my mind. And I didn't know that when I got into this. I got into this to tell a story about men doing hard work. Cowboys on the plains, you know, delivering the beef, you know, and that wild type of personality. And they are that kind of guy. But I didn't realize how corporate the distance was between the men who make your system work and the men who fill your pockets, and how you deny their fatalities. And we've had hundreds and hundreds of them in the last 10 years. Hundreds.
And yet you're really quick to point out in Tower Dog that most of the fatalities are not due to structural problems or equipment failures. They're operator error.
Glad you said that. We call it pilot error, the moron syndrome. And what happens is this. This is because they're untrained and they're unskilled and they're overworked and they're tired. Okay? It's not because they're stupid or they have a death wish, but it is a fact. And this is a true fact. I did 97% of fatalities you can trace to the worker on the tower. They kill themselves. And they don't kill themselves on purpose. They kill themselves because they're overtired, overworked, not paying attention, and they make that one mistake. It's one. You get one. And I'm serious. When you're working in the kitchen and you spill a cup of coffee, you spill a cup of coffee. When you're working on a tower and you don't do aid a certain way, you're dead. It's that simple, you know. Anything over 50 feet we consider is dead, really. Very few people survive over a 50-foot fall. It's gravity. It's usually fatigue, non-training, and it's very rarely not using the equipment they wear. It costs hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars. They know how to use it. But you'll read over and over and over again. Victim A was found on the ground. He was wearing his harness, but it isn't clear if his harness was connected to the tower or not. Well, how stupid is that? You have to be connected to the tower. It's your lifeline. And it's the simplest thing in the world. And it is drilled into their heads over and over and over again. 100% tie off. 100%. That's how you don't die. Yet you're still dying. As a matter of fact, since I spoke to you about 4 weeks ago, we've lost four guys. One in Arkansas, three in Miami. How? How did that happen? That's between OSHA and the lawyers right now. Something went wrong. Was it structural? Were they not? Did they make a mistake? Like I said, I can't blame carriers like AT&T and Verizon and the whole, I can't blame them for these mistakes. I can blame them for not taking responsibility for these mistakes. That's the issue that I really care about. Take the responsibility. Better trained men, more money, you get a better type of worker in the field who might then pay a little more attention to what the hell they're doing.
I'm glad you brought up OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration,
yes.
Because you make the point in your book, Tower Dog, that contrary to what you might think, most of the men that work as tower dogs see OSHA not as their protector, but as their enemy.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. Every working man hates OSHA because they think OSHA costs them money. That's not true. Every employer of a working man thinks OSHA costs them money. That's the difference. A tower dog's best friend is OSHA. OSHA cares more about tower dogs than any carrier or any contractor or any super contractor ever will. Frankly, I'm going to say it. Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, Cell One, T-Mobile, they don't give a damn about the tower dog. They really don't. They care about service, coverage, and profit. I get it. OSHA cares. But it's trained into these men's heads that OSHA is an enemy because they are enforcing rules on you that make work constricting. No, you don't have to be tied off to one spot. You got to be tied off to two spots. Well, that's going to take twice as long. Okay, you're screwing up my work. Yeah, but I'm going to keep you alive. Yeah, but I can't get done as fast. I can't get paid as much. Now, they don't even realize OSHA's their best friend. And I really believe they are. I grew up in a union family in New York. I heard about OSHA gripes all my life. OSHA is really there to protect a worker. The worker. It goes back to the jungle. It goes back to there will be blood. You need this enforcement. But they have no teeth. They don't have enough guys in this field. To get back to one small point, though, and this, to me, is what blows my mind. When OSHA says, we are going to impose these rules on you, the lowest contractor in the chain, the guy with three guys in the field on a tower, you're going to pay for the upgrades and equipment. You're going to pay for the upgrades and training. You're going to pay for the upgrades and the constant testing and retesting that we do, and we do. We're not going to pay for that, and we're going to pay you the same amount of money. So when OSHA does initiate standards and protocols that increase a small business's overhead by as much as 30%, 35%, does AT&T and General Dynamics pick up that? No, they do not. They just make you take it out of your own profit, and then you find yourself pushing guys longer hours, pushing guys to completion. It is a horrible cycle, and that is the fact of it.
I'm visiting with Douglas Scott Delaney. He's the author of Tower Dog, Life Inside the Deadliest Job in America. Doug, when you were working as a tower dog, I guess I'm going to put you on the spot here. How careful were you at following all of those OSHA directives?
When I first started, we were horrible because OSHA wasn't even the mix. When I first started, and I'm not going back 100 years, I'm not Tarzan. We went back, we would climb, free climb all the time. We just free climbed. When we got tired, we would belt off, as they say, connect ourselves to the tower. But belting off is very restrictive. It's changed for the better. It has changed like night and day since I first started. And it's changed even more than that the guys that started 20 years before I did. You know, there were guys doing this in the 50s and 60s. I didn't start till the late 90s. And you see pictures of this. They were just like that famous picture of 30 Rock where you see nine guys sitting on an iron beam. That was it. That's what you did. Okay, but that's the way it was done. No, it's changed a lot and for the better. Like I said, the new rules and regulations are restrictive on your movement, and you have to understand, you're in a harness all the time, and you're trying to do orangutan kind of work where you need nine feet arms and your legs, and you're constantly upside down and over. It's not conducive. It's not a natural state of working. When I started, we free climbed all the time. We wore shorts. We didn't wear shirts. That's all changed. Didn't wear hard hats. And that's one of the funniest rules in the business is when you're on a tower, you have to wear a hard hat because what the hell's going to fall on you, right? We have to wear hard hats. They restrict us. As a matter of fact, more guys have injuries from wearing hard hats than not because it restricts their vision and they're constantly hitting their heads on stuff. I understand if you're below somebody, you wear your hard hat. When you're on top of the world, you don't wear a hard hat. That's one of the rules that everybody gripes about. Etc. It's changed quite a bit, and all for the better, frankly.
Hmm. Did you have any close calls?
Oh yeah, I've had a couple, but they were the type where I had my equipment on, and I fell once, and I was in Dixon, Tennessee. I was on a 240-foot tower. I had gone up and I had gone out on what they call a boom on. Just picture walking out on a pipe, and I had clipped off my belt. And I stepped on something that broke. And I went down about 3.5 feet. And when I fell, I went boom. And that whole tower shook back and forth, back and forth. And they call it the 2-second heart attack. I thought I was dead. And it's 3.5 feet. And I thought it was over. I'd never been so scared in my life. Never been so scared in my life. And I clawed my way back up, climbed on down, took my belt, said I'm done for the day. Ain't going to do that again. If I wasn't belted off, I'd be dead. So, yeah, I've had a couple of close calls. but nothing fatal, obviously.
Not only do tower dogs put towers up and repair them, you get to also take them down. Take us to Hollis, Oklahoma, and decommissioning a tower, which you describe as the most fun a tower dog can have.
It's the most fun you can have in the world. You finally get to tear one down. You know what I mean? I've heard guys tell these stories. It's just like sometimes it's fun to blow stuff up. You know, this was a 300-foot tower outside of Hollis, Oklahoma. Very tiny, dried-up little old cotton town. And we were there forever prepping to drop this 300-foot tower. Well, the town got news of what we were doing. And we told them we were going to drop it. And they came out in their cars and their pickup trucks. And they brought coolers and they brought lawn chairs. And they showed up that morning to watch us drop this tower. And I won't get into specifics. There's many ways to drop a tower, but the funnest way is just to cut it down and let it fall. And in Hollis, Oklahoma, we had that kind of room, and we dropped this thing. I actually have footage of it. We dropped this 300-foot tower, and it was just lethargic and fun. It was just it was just this massive destruction that we were allowed to do. And the crowd cheered. The smoke went up. It was wonderful. It was a good time. I've only dropped about four of them. That had to be the funnest because it was done right. It was done well.
It sounds like fun.
It was fun. It's like when people go to Vegas to watch a building blow up. That's as close as we get to doing that, is to take one down.
Let's travel down from Oklahoma down to Mississippi. Tell me about Luann and a conversation that you got
listen in on. I think I'm still in love with her. I never met her. Sometimes, back when I first started, there was what they call bleeding. Whether it was on your handheld radio or your cell phone, which is much more simpler than it is today. It wasn't as specific and targeted. You would get bleed. Like, I remember we were in a tower in Atlanta all day long. All we kept hearing was the drive-through from Burger King. All day long. We couldn't even talk to each other. We were just hearing people's orders. You know, you only hear one side. We couldn't hear the woman saying, would you like fries with that? All we heard was, I want A, B, C, and D. And it was late at night. I was in Mississippi, and for about four or five nights in a row, every night at about 10-ish, I'd get this bleed through on my radio, and it was a woman talking to her girlfriend. And I could hear her, she could hear me, but her girlfriend couldn't hear either of us. And I listened to her, and she was telling the saddest story I ever heard. It was, she was having trouble with her man. He took the kids, he got in the car. You don't know where he is. He spent the money, spent the rent, and she's there by herself. Doesn't know where she is. Doesn't know what she's going to do. And I think by the third night or so, I just got on and I said, hi. Who is this? And I said, I'm the Night Whisperer. Who is this? And she thought it was someone on her friend's phone. She had no idea who I was. And I proceeded to tell her that I'm everywhere. I'm omnipresent. I can solve your problems if you'll just listen to me. And I just started talking to her and saying, you know, you're better than this. You can figure it out. Go take care of problems. You know, handle your business. You have a friend. And the next few nights, she started to say, hello, are you there? Are you there? Yeah, I'm here. And her girlfriend's going crazy on the other line because she doesn't know we're actually talking to each other. And that's all more specifically described in the book. But it was how we left it was, I remember the last thing I said to her was, aren't you feeling better already? And she said, yes, I am. And I said, okay. So I made up this whole fantasy in my mind about how I'd go to that little town down there, then I'd meet her and we'd be friends and I'd talk to her, and you know, and if she was pretty, I had no idea, but it was a fun moment, you know. And but I seriously connected with her because I was a voice she had never heard before, and I think I was the only person in her life who said, you're better than this, you don't need this guy. Contact social services, make some phone calls. She didn't really have the wherewithal to do that at the time. But I do know her girlfriend, who couldn't hear me, thought she went totally bat crazy.
I'm visiting with Douglas Scott Delaney. He's the author of Tower Dog, Life Inside the Deadliest Job in America. Doug, I feel like there's kind of two things going on here. There's the you working as a tower dog, but then also at the same time, you're trying to sell this story to a television station.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that came about and where you wanted to go with this story.
Well, that happened kind of strange. What had happened was I had been in the business before. I had written screenplays for studios. I had some plays done, and you know, I had been a writer, a working writer for a while. And what happened was I thought I was always trying to pitch this to some Hollywood people as a movie. This would make a great movie. You would love this movie. This was before Perfect Storm, which was a fantastic movie. I'm not even comparing it to. What I'm saying was I was pitching this work kind of thing, and really based on some of the tragedies that had happened in the field. Well, the head of Universal at the time I had worked for, and to make a long story short, he sent me to NBC, and rather than do a reality show, they wanted to do a Dateline special and run it up the flagpole to see if anybody would buy it as a reality show. So they were packaging an hour of this. And this is also when Ice Road Truckers and Deadliest Catch were becoming very popular. So it was at the crest of that thing. But I walked in and told them flat out, you got nothing on us. You ain't seen nothing yet. And they bought into it. And what happened was they went into the field. They shot for almost a year and a half. And they made a Dateline special that aired in 2008. And before it even aired, they had sold a reality show to they had offers from four cable networks. They ended up selling it to the History Channel. But before it even aired, based on the promos, they had bought this reality show on Tower Dogs. And then something else happened. So.
What else happened?
Well, History Channel bought it. They sent us into the field. We had $300,000 worth of brand new shooting equipment from an NBC. They had a crew of seven. We were working out of 30 Rock. We had producers who had worked on all kinds of things, and Dateline specials, etc. PAs and everything. We went into the field to shoot, and within the first week, we were completely shut down and told to cease, stop.
Shut down by whom?
We still don't know. Technically, NBC. And I think, frankly, we were shut down by people who didn't want this story told whatsoever. Because when the Dateline special came out, it was received by the general public very well. It was received by the industry very poorly. They filleted us. They wanted this light hidden under a bushel. The industry didn't want to see a bunch of crazy people running around the country getting paid nothing and dying. The industry wanted a bunch of choir boys wearing chevron suits and little white hats. I can't say what happened. I have my suspicions, but that's all detailed in the book as well. And I'm not using that as a selling point, but it's a complicated issue. It's like, I don't know whether they realized it was more expensive to do this reality show than any, or that GE, who owned NBC at the time, who was shooting this for History Channel, said, yeah, we're not sure we want to see that. I don't know. I really don't know. To this day, I don't know.
At the same time, you yourself are kind of grappling in the book with, am I a tower dog? Am I a writer?
Yeah.
Am I a tower dog? Am I a writer?
Yeah, it's true. It's because, this funny thing is, while this was going on with NBC, I had given up writing for years. I'd gone back to towers. I had been in L.A. I had been in New York. I'd done theater. I've done these things. And I made an okay living for a while. There was nothing steady about it. So you go back to towers, it's a fallback position. The job is always there. And it wasn't until almost 4 or 5 years after the Dateline thing and the History Channel show was canceled, I actually sat down and started writing the book because I wanted to be a writer again, to be honest. And I wanted to do something I'd never done before, which was nonfiction. which I find I love better than anything else. I mean, I don't even read fiction. I don't watch fiction. To me, and I've written fiction, and I've written plays, and I've written screenplays, and I've written drama. And they have been done. I mean, I've had moderate success at this, but never a big success. Nobody knows who I am. It plays in Peoria sometimes. But the telling the absolute truth, when I sat down to write this, I said, I'm going to tell the unvarnished truth. What happened, how I feel, what went down, what the weather was like. What Hemingway say? Tell people what happened, what the weather was like? Kind of like that. Pretty much. You know, I pulled no punches. I got in a lot of trouble for it. It didn't bother me all that much, but I got in a lot of trouble. We had to change a lot of names, et cetera. I didn't go into muckrake. I went in to tell a story that I think needed to be told. And my agent in New York said, what do you want this to be? And I said, I want this to be my jungle. I really meant that. I want this to be my jungle. I want this to be something that changes something. I don't know if it will. I don't think it has so far. But at least I tried.
I'm Kay McIntyre, visiting with Douglas Scott Delaney. He's the author of Tower Dog, Life Inside the Deadliest Job in America. Kansas Public Radio has a copy of Tower Dog to give away. If you'd like a chance to win a copy, leave a message on Kansas Public Radio's Facebook page or enter on our website, kansaspublicradio.org. Look under Extras and Available Giveaways. My conversation with Doug Delaney will continue in just a minute, but first, a reminder that KPR Presents is locally produced public radio. That means that this show relies on listener support to make it happen, from the interviews, the on-site recordings of lectures and panels, to the editing and production it takes to put it on the air. We're in the midst of KPR's Campaign for Excellence 2018, one of the few times of the year that we come to you and ask, what's this worth to you? Locally produced public affairs, coverage of what's happening in Kansas politics, lectures at the University of Kansas Dole Institute of Politics, and the Kansas State University Landon Lecture Series. We know you can't make it to all the things you'd like to, and that's where we come in. We bring you some of the most interesting people who come to Kansas, and sometimes Missouri. KPR Presents has been on the air now for 11 years. Think about all the people you've heard over those 11 years. Presidents, poets, Pulitzer Prize winners, and everything in between. Maybe you've won a book, like Doug Delaney's Tower Dog. Over the past 11 years, we've given away dozens of books. Even if you haven't won a book, maybe you've heard about an author you'd like to explore further. What's that worth to you? During our Campaign for Excellence, consider pledging $10 or $20 a month to support the kind of public radio you've come to rely on every week at this time. Call us at 888-KPR-KANU. That's 888-577-5268. Or you can pledge online at our secure website, kansaspublicradio.org. I can't tell you what to pledge, what KPR Presents and Kansas Public Radio is worth to you, but I can tell you that every pledge helps make this show happen. So whether you pledge $20 a month, give a one-time gift of $50 or $500, or you decide to become a sustaining member, know that your pledge of support keeps this program on the air. When you pledge, we'll even ask you what programs you enjoy on Kansas Public Radio. Whether it's KPR Presents, Morning Edition, or Trail Mix, do let us know why you listen to Kansas Public Radio. Again, our website is kansaspublicradio.org or call us at 888-577-5268. That number again, 888-KPR-KANU. And from all of us at Kansas Public Radio, thanks for your support. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. We're on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from Theater Lawrence, presenting The Glass Menagerie, an exploration of the human heart as a single mother strives to secure a future for her two grown children. Playing weekends, April 20th through April 29th. Tickets at theaterlawrence.com. And from Audio Reader's 9th Annual Golf Classic, a fundraising event for the Reading Service, Monday, June 4th at Eagle Bend Golf Course. Registration is available at 785-864-5336. Deadline, May 18th. April 2nd, 2018, Utica, Mississippi. 34-year-old Melvin Ronnie Nelson. December 28th, 2017, Mishicot, Wisconsin, 31-year-old Richard C. Andrews. December 9th, 2017, Ransom, Kansas, 39-year-old Clayton Barnhill. September 27th, 2017, Miami, Florida, 31-year-old Marcus Gafina, 35-year-old Benito Rodriguez, 23-year-old Bracton Barber. The list of fatalities goes on and on and on. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, Tower Dog, Life Inside the Deadliest Job in America. I'm visiting with Douglas Scott Delaney, who worked on cell phone towers across the country for more than 20 years before writing Tower Dog, a look at the men and women, but mostly men, who do this dangerous work. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Doug, you start each of the chapters of Tower Dog with essentially an obituary.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do that?
I did it to bring it up to date. Most of the book takes place in 2008, but when the book was published, the last fatality was a week before the book was published. I wanted, between chapters, every reader to know that guy died in Alabama today. 12 pages later, these three guys died in Louisiana. These are real things. These are real people with real families. That's a face. Never get mentioned. If you'll notice, all those, they're not obituaries from funeral parlors. They are news releases from OSHA. They are news releases from TV stations, news releases from trade, news releases from radio stations. What they are is, they're the facts that I never, ever wanted the reader to forget that people are dying as they read this. As you read this, people are dying. And the only way I could figure out to do it was to put it in on chapter breaks. Because I'll go two or three chapters with all our guys doing what they do, you know, and nobody's dying. But while we were out there working, people were dying all over the country. Just because they weren't with me doesn't mean they weren't dying. And to be honest with you, I have how many chapters in the book? Is the book is, Lord, I forget, isn't that funny? The book is 20 chapters. In order to get all the deaths in, right, I'd need 180 chapters. You know, but I tried to start from the most recent and work backward. So as the book is moving forward, the death count is starting at the present and working back. That makes sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. As a reader, I think it was it really brought home sort of the relentless drive of the industry, and that these deaths are continuing to happen over and over and over again, and it never lets that out of your sight as you're being drawn into the story.
Well, I wanted that always in the back of your mind. That now, this book can be funny in places. It could be tragic in places. It could be informative, I think, in places. Especially, it's almost a travelogue in a lot of ways. That when we go to places, the Flint Hills or Jersey or the Palouse. But I really wanted to always keep, without hammering it too hard, I thought that was the best day to do it. And not my writing. These were footnoted excerpts from stations, whatever. I always wanted to hang that hat there. That hat's there. And that, to me, is the gist of the book. Whoever reads it, when you look at that light and you look at that tower, you're going to remember one of these guys. You're going to remember the guy who got decapitated in Kentucky, or the three guys who went down in Louisiana. Or, my God, the most tragic story to me was the 19-year-old kid in Iowa who told his mom that he thought he was in heaven that night. That, to me, is the most heartbreaking part of the book. Now, I want you to remember those guys. That's what it's about, really, is the fallen, is the fallen. And when 5G hits, it's just like a graph. When technology build-outs are low, fatalities will be low. When it kicks in, they're going to be high because you're going to be throwing people out into the field that don't have enough training and don't have enough experience, and they're going to be falling again. It's not going to change.
For the most part, this is a really male-dominated industry, mm-hmm. with one notable exception. Tell me about Nikki.
Nikki was a dog. Nikki was, I had met several women workers in the field. Nikki was a crew leader who ran a crew of three guys who were just as rough and tumble as they come. One of them very problematic, just the same as every tower crew out there. They're like, I don't know how to describe these guys, but they're just different.
Hard drinking, hard living, I think is maybe the best way.
Hard living, hard drugging. You know, to an extent, but no more than any other construction field, no more than roofers or welders or bike. It's but on when you're 200 feet, 500 feet in the air, there is a difference. Nikki was this very adorable little girl from Alabama, just cute as a pumpkin. I mean, just the cutest little thing you ever seen, but she was tough. She was a crew leader. And I first met her when they did the start of the NBC shooting. I didn't know her that long. I knew she ran crews. In the field, and she was tough, she was hardcore, and she handled it. But the most interesting thing about Nikki was when NBC and the History Channel saw the footage of what we were doing, didn't matter if Nikki sat in a truck all day, they had to have Nikki. They had to have Nikki. It didn't matter that she wasn't doing the most dangerous work or the most interesting work. They wanted her because that is the way it works. They wanted what they called, and I swear to God they used this word, sizzle. She was a sizzle. She was a sex. She was very attractive. She was smart, and she was funny, and I could see how you could be drawn to her. But they went for her like you wouldn't believe. As a matter of fact, when they were making offers on the show to Peacock Productions, which is the vision of NBC, when Nat Geo and History and when all these cable channels were making offers, one of their caveats was, we got to have Nikki. We got to have Nikki. So I think she's still working out there. She's still running crews. God love her. You know, her 15 minutes of fame never went to her head.
Doug, a lot of people die over the course of this book. But yeah. Tell me about the death of Triple J.
Triple J. He was one of ours. He was the only guy in the book that died that I knew personally, that we knew personally. He was one of us. We brought him in. We trained him. He was a kid from Alabama, northeast Alabama. There's a thing about him that's typical of tower guys. He was bold but ignorant. He was brave but ill-informed. He thought he was bulletproof. You know, he was one of those thrill seekers that you want to break like a horse. And my boss used to say, like, I don't want them, you know, to be afraid of the tower, but I want them to respect the tower. I want them to fear it. He would say, you want your kids to jump into the pool, but you don't want them to drown. That was his attitude towards his men. We want him. It takes guts to do this job. It takes a little bit of bravado, a little bit of machismo. But at the same time, you have to have respect for what you're doing. And to make a long story, he was the first and only man my company ever lost. And we had employed hundreds and hundreds of men on thousands and thousands of towers. And he died, frankly, because he broke more rules on a tower than any one man should have broken. Not to get technical, there were five different ways he shouldn't have died that day. He broke every one of them. Any one of those things, if he would have done, would have saved his life. And he left behind a child, and he left behind a woman. You know, and that's it. He's done. 25.
Doug, what is it you hope that our listeners take from Tower Dog?
I'm not going to bandy about the politics of the industry too much because to me it's self-evident that you have robber barons and you have coolies. and these men are coolies. And that's all I can say about it. The men who provide the convenience for your life are underpaid and overworked. That's a fact. Okay, now, they're not being whipped with whips. They're not on a chain gang. They do this of their own volition. Okay, that's not the point. Keep that in the back of your mind, though. They need a little bit more money. The truth is, I don't want anybody to ever look at a cell phone tower the same way. Just like I looked at that tower that Jerry Case and Kevin Keeling died on. That changed my life. Because I had stared at it every day off my back porch when I lived in the country outside of Lawrence. Till I realized, and I had known about tower deaths, I'd heard about them all my life, but till it happened 4 miles from my house and two men hit the ground at 138 miles an hour, okay, I hadn't realized that cost. It didn't hit home yet. And it didn't even till 5 years later. It gestated a while. I want everyone who reads this book or listens to this, when you see that light, when you see that tower, I want you to remember, because, and I hope to God you're not texting when you're driving by it, right? There's a blood cost for that service, for that thing in your hand, when you're texting, calling, Garmin, wonderful, nice, hands-free, hands-on, Bluetooth, I don't give a damn, it don't matter. There's a cost to be paid, and it's being paid on a bi-weekly basis, most likely. Sometimes more, sometimes less.
One death every 33 days.
Well, that's the low average, about every 33 to 40 days. There was a time back, during the height of the book, we lost a guy every 6 days. You know, six guys in 32 days because they were doing a big 4G build out. Might have been 3G, could have been 4G. It was 3G. Except when there's a build out, 3G, 4G, there's a joke. In our business, 4G means I've been up the tower 4GD times. That's 4G. It means we're going back up. They change the technology. They swap it out. They're getting faster and faster. They're putting more and more of this technology on the worker himself. It used to be what a cell phone guy did, put up one antenna, one line, snapped it in, went to the ground, day was done. No, now we're doing the work that technicians used to do on the ground for no more money, for no more pay. These guys are quasi-electronic geniuses up there. And most of them barely got out of high school. And they're doing work that if you looked at, you'd go, oh my God, I don't know what to do with this. But yeah, it's a G build out.
Doug, can I get you to read an excerpt from Tower Dog?
Yeah. Okay. I'll read this. The interesting part about this is you're going to hear some technical language, but this is how OSHA does report an accident. This was, by the way, the sixth man to die in 2007, number six. Name withheld, age withheld. Pinola, Mississippi, July 5th, 2007. At approximately 1 p.m. on July 5th, 2007, employee number one was on a crew of five, including the supervisor, that was installing three boom gates on a 300-foot-tall telecommunication tower under construction. Using a cat head to hoist the booms, they successfully installed the first boom. Employee number one rigged the hoist line by connecting a snatch block to the top flange of the southwest tower leg, connecting a carabiner through a bolt hole on the flange, and finally connecting the load hook of the snatch block to the carabiner. The crew then moved on to the second boom. It had been lifted to the highest point allowed by the rigging configuration, and employee number one radioed to the hoist operator to stop. To get the boom to the required installation location, employee number one had to use a come-along to lift it another 5 to 6 feet. Before he could connect the boom to the come-along, the carabiner broke, and the boom struck employee number one on the head, neck, and shoulder, severing his right arm. He did not lose consciousness, and two co-workers on the tower tied employee number one's arm in place and helped him climb down nearly 300 feet. He was transported by ambulance to a local hospital and then transferred to the University Medical Center in Jackson. He died 2 days later of head injuries sustained in the incident. That was an OSHA report summary. Two more deaths in September and December in Pennsylvania and New Jersey would bring the year's total to 11. These men worked for 9 different companies of varying sizes and specialties. These men were in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 70s. Some were married, some were not. Some had children, Some did not. Some had decades of experience. Some had weeks. And only one of them got to say goodbye. At least I would hope so. Though linked by their vocation and the grisly manner of their passings, the only two things they had in common, with the exception of the man in Pinole, Mississippi, was the confidence to flout the first and most important rule of tower climbing, belt the hell off, and the conviction they would not die that day in doing so. In coroner's offices across America, there are thousands of photos depicting brutally broken bodies lying lifeless and bloodied, wearing perfectly serviceable climbing harnesses. I sometimes wonder why we even issue the damn things, our safety manager would say. We know the climber in East Deer Township, Pennsylvania, Daniel Plants, broke two rules. He obviously didn't belt off, and he was also working alone, a massive no-no. Nobody knows when he fell or from how high on the 100-foot self-support tower. His body was found by a little girl walking her dog, something I'm sure she will carry with her for the rest of her life. But at least she has the rest of her life. That's more than Arthur Crane of Stanhope, New Jersey, the last casualty of the year, had.
Douglas Scott Delaney is the author of Tower Dog, Life Inside the Deadliest Job in America. Doug, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Kansas Public Radio has a copy of Tower Dog to give away. If you'd like a chance to win a copy, leave a message on Kansas Public Radio's Facebook page or enter at KPR's website, kansaspublicradio.org. Click on Extras and then Available Giveaways. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. If today's KPR Presents gave you something to think about, if today's KPR Presents made you want to read more about this subject, if today's KPR Presents sparked your interest, ask yourself this. What's that worth to you? $10 a month? $1 a day? If you only listen to KPR Presents and nothing else on Kansas Public Radio, you'd still get 520 hours of locally produced public affairs programming over the course of the year. And what did you hear in that year? You heard former Los Angeles Laker Byron Scott. You heard authors like Tom Averill, Laura Moriarty, and Sarah Paretsky. You heard about the total solar eclipse that drew thousands of people to Northeast Kansas to look up at the skies. Whether you've been listening to KPR Presents for just a year or for several years now, think about what that's worth to you. During our Campaign for Excellence, consider pledging $10 or $20 a month to support the kind of public radio you've come to rely on every week at this time. I can't tell you what to pledge, what KPR Presents and Kansas Public Radio is worth to you, but I can tell you that every pledge helps make this show happen. Whether you pledge $10 or $20 a month or decide to become a sustaining member, know that your pledge of support keeps this program on the air. And when you pledge, we'll ask you what programs do you like to listen to on Kansas Public Radio. I hope you'll say KPR Presents. Let us know that you support locally produced news and public affairs, radio that you won't hear anywhere else. You've already made the choice to listen to Kansas Public Radio. Choose to become a listener member. Join the 17,000 people who support KPR with a financial pledge. It's our biggest source of support, and now more than ever, we rely on you. Call now at 888-577-5268. That's 888-KPR-KANU. Or pledge online at our secure website, kansaspublicradio.org.